Avienda's companions had all taken cover and they continued to feed her their strength. Such power! It was distracting. She judged the source of the attacks. "Be ready to follow," she said to the others, then made a gateway to the point where the weave had begun. "Come through after me, but take cover immediately." She leaped through, skirts swishing, the one power held like thunder somehow contained. She landed on a slope overlooking the battlefield. Below, maidens and men fought Trollocs. It looked as if the Aiel were holding back a vast black flood. Avienda didn't spare time for more than a quick glance. She dug into the ground with a primal weave of earth and ripped up a horse-sized chunk of rock, popping it into the air. The beam that came for her a second later struck the chunk of rock. Balefire was a dangerous spear to wield. Sometimes it cut, but if it hit a distant object, a person, for example, it caused the entire thing to flash and vanish. The balefire burned Avienda's chunk from existence in a flash, dropping motes of glowing dust that soon vanished. Behind her, the men and women in her circle dashed through her gateway and took cover. Avienda barely had time to notice that nearby, cracks had appeared in the rock. Cracks that seemed to look down into darkness. As the bar of light faded in Avienda's vision, she released a burning column of fire. This time she met flesh, burning away a coppery-skinned, slender woman in a red dress. Two other women nearby cursed, scrambling away. Avienda launched a second attack at the others. One of the two, the strongest, made a weave with such skill and speed that Avienda barely caught sight of it. The weave went up in front of her column of fire, and the result was an explosion of blistering steam. Avienda's fire was extinguished, and she gasped, temporarily blinded. Battle instincts took over. Obscured by the cloud of steam, she dropped to her knees, then rolled to the side while grabbing a handful of rocks and tossing them away from her to create a distraction. It worked. As she blinked tears from her eyes, a white-hot bar struck toward the sound of the rocks. Those dark cracks spread further. Avienda blew the steam away with a weave of air while still blinking tears. She could see well enough to distinguish two black shapes crouching nearby on the rocks. One turned toward her, gasped, seeing the attack weaves that Avienda was making, then vanished. There was no gateway. The person just seemed to fold up on herself, and Avienda sensed no channeling. She did feel something else. A faint something. A tremble to the air that wasn't entirely physical. "No," the second woman said. Just a blur to Avienda's tear-streaked eyes. "Don't!" Avienda's vision cleared just enough to make out the woman's features. A long face and dark hair as her weave struck the woman. The woman's limbs ripped from her body. A smoldering arm spun in the air, creating a swirl of black smoke before hitting nearby. Avienda coughed, then released the circle. "Healing," she said, struggling to her feet. Bera Harkin reached her first, and a healing weave set Avienda trembling. She panted, and her reddened skin, her singed eyes, were repaired. She nodded in thanks to Bera, whom she could now see clearly. Ahead of her, Serene, an Aes Sedai with a teardrop face and numerous dark braids, stepped up to the corpses Avienda had made, her warder, Vitalian, close by her side. She shook her head. "Duara and Phalion, dreadlords now." "There's a difference between dreadlords and Black Aja?" Amis asked. "Of course," Serene said with a calm tone. Nearby, the others still held the one power, expecting another attack. Avienda didn't think there would be one. She had heard that gasp of surprise, sensed the panic in the way the final woman, the strongest of the three, had fled. Perhaps she hadn't anticipated facing such powerful resistance so quickly. Serene kicked at an arm that had been Phalion's. "Better to have taken them alive for questioning. I'm certain we could have learned the identity of that third woman. Did anyone recognize her? Members of the group shook their heads. She was not anyone on the list of Black Aja who escaped, Serene said, taking the arm of her warder. She has a distinctive face, so bulbous and lacking any qualities of charm. I'm certain I would remember her. She was powerful, Avienda said. Very powerful. Avienda would have guessed her as one of the Forsaken, but that certainly hadn't been Mogadin, and it didn't match the description of Grendahl. We'll split into three circles, Avienda said. Bera will lead one of them, Amis and I the others. Yes, we can make circles larger than 13 now, but it seems a waste. I don't need that much power to kill. One of our groups will attack the Trollocs below. The other two will avoid channeling and hide nearby watching. That way we can goad the enemy channeler into assuming we're still in one large circle, and the other two can strike at her from the sides when she comes to attack. Amis smiled. She recognized this as a basic maiden raiding tactic. She didn't seem particularly put out to be following Avienda's orders, now that annoyance at Rand's presumption had faded. In fact, if anything, she and the other four wise ones looked proud. As Avienda's team obeyed, she sensed more channeling on the battlefield. Cadswain and those who followed her liked to consider themselves outside Rand's orders. They fought while another group of Aes Sedai and Ashaman held open gateways to usher through the Demonian Tyran armies. Too many people channeling all about. It was going to grow difficult to pinpoint an attack by one of the Forsaken. We need to set up traveling grounds, Avienda said, and keep strict control over who is going to channel and where. That way we'll be able to tell in an instant when we sense channeling if something is wrong. She raised her hand to her head. This is going to be very difficult to organize. Nearby, Amis's smile widened. You are in command now, Avienda, that smile seemed to say. And leadership's headaches are yours to endure.
Randall Thor, the dragon reborn, turned away from Avienda and left her and Acheralda to their battle. He had a different one to join. At last, the time had come. He approached the base of the mountain of Shale Ghul. Above, a black hole burrowed into the mountain face, the only way to reach the Pit of Doom. Moraine joined him, pulling close her rippling shawl, its blue fringe catching in the wind. Remember, this is not the Boar. This is not the Dark One's prison. This is merely the place where his touch is strongest upon the world. He has control here. He touches the entire world now, to one extent or another, Rand said. And so his touch here will be stronger. Rand nodded, setting his hand upon the dagger he wore at his belt. No channeling until we strike at the Dark One directly. If possible, I would avoid a fight like the one we had at the cleansing. What comes will require all of my strength. Nynaeve nodded. She wore her Angreal and Tirangreal jewelry over a gown of yellow, one far more beautiful than she would ever have allowed herself during their days in the Two Rivers. She looked strange to him without her braid, her hair now barely to her shoulders. She seemed somehow older. That shouldn't be. The braid was a symbol of age and maturity in the Two Rivers. Why should Nynaeve look older without it? Tom stepped up beside Rand, squinting up at the hole in the rock. I suspect I'm not going in with you. Moraine looked at him, pursing her lips. Someone will need to guard the entry into the cave, my wife, Tom said. That ledge up there, right beside the opening, has an excellent view of the battlefield. I can watch the battle below, maybe compose a good ballad or two. Rand smiled at the spark of humor in Tom's eyes. They stood at the edge of time itself, and still Tom Marilyn found a smile. Above them, dark clouds spun, the peak of Sheol Ghul their axis. Darkness assaulted the sun until it was nearly gone, entirely covered, in total oblivion. Rand's forces stopped, staring in terror at the sky, and even the Trollocs paused, growling and hooting. But as the sun slowly emerged from its captivity, the fierce battle resumed in the valley below. It announced his intentions, but the dagger would shield him from the Dark One's eyes. The Light willing, the Shadow's leaders would focus on the battle and assume Rand would wait for its outcome before striking. "Now?" Nynaeve asked, looking up at the narrow stony pathway to the cavern. Rand nodded and led the way forward. A wind rose, whipping at the four as they climbed the pathway. He had chosen his clothing deliberately. His red coat, embroidered with long-thorned briars on the sleeves and golden herons on the collar, was a twin to one of those Moraine had arranged for him to receive in Feldara. The white shirt, laced across the front, was of Two Rivers' make. Kalendor was on his back, the sword of layman at his hip. It had been a long time since he'd chosen to wear that, but it felt appropriate. The winds buffeted him, threatening to throw him from the heights. He pushed forward anyway, climbing the steep hill, gritting his teeth against the pain in his side. Time seemed to have less meaning here, and he felt as if he'd been walking for days when he reached the flat area before the cavern. He turned, resting one hand against the rock of the open maw, and looked out over the valley. His forces in the valley seemed so fragile, so insignificant. Would they be able to hold it long enough? "Rand," Nynaeve said, taking his arm. "Perhaps you should rest." He looked down, following her eyes to his side. His wound, the old wound, had broken open again. He felt blood inside his boot. It had run down his side, down his leg, and when he moved his foot, he left a bloody footprint behind. "Blood on the rocks." Nynaeve raised a hand to her mouth. "It has to happen, Nynaeve," Rand said. "You cannot stop it. The prophecy does not say anything about me living through this. I have always found that odd, haven't you? Why would it speak of the blood, but not what comes after?" He shook his head, then unsheathed Kalendor from his back. "Moraine, Nynaeve, will you lend me your strength and join me in a circle?" "Do you wish one of us to lead?" Moraine said hesitantly. "So you can use that safely?" "I'm not planning to be safe," Rand said. "A circle, please." The two women exchanged a look. So long as he led the circle, another could strike and seize control of him. Neither liked the request, obviously. He wasn't certain if he should be pleased that the two of them had started to get along. Perhaps instead he should worry about them teaming up against him. That seemed like a thought from simpler days. Easier days. He smiled wryly, but knew that the smile did not reach his eyes. Moraine and Nynaeve fed him their strength, and he accepted it. Tom kissed Moraine, and then the three of them turned to regard the opening before them. It led back down, toward the base of the mountain, and the fiery pit that was the closest thing this world knew to the Dark One's dwelling. Shadows from a returned sun dimmed the cavern mouth around him. Wind tugged at him, his foot warm with his own blood. "I will not walk out of this pit alive," he thought. He no longer cared. Survival was not his goal. It had not been for some time. He did want to do this right. He had to do this right. Was it the right time? Had he planned well enough?
"It is time. Let the task be undertaken."
The voice spoke with the inevitability of an earthquake, the words vibrating through him. More than sound in the air, far more, the words spoke as if from one soul to another. Moraine gasped, eyes opening wide. Rand was not surprised. He had heard this voice once before, and he realized that he had been expecting it. Hoping for it, at least.
"Thank you," Rand said.
then stepped forward into the Dark One's realm, leaving footprints of blood behind.
Chapter 24. To Ignore the Omens. Fortuona, Empress of the Shanshan Empire, studied her husband as he gave orders to their forces. They were arrayed outside the palace in Ebu Dar, and she herself sat upon an elaborate mobile throne, outfitted with poles at the bottom so she could be carried by a dozen soldiers. The throne lent her grandeur, but also gave an illusion of immobility. An assassin would assume that she could not move quickly while wearing her formal silks, her gown draping down in front and tumbling toward the ground. They would be surprised, then, that she could break free of the outer garments at the flick of a wrist.
"He has changed, Greatest One," Beslan said to her. "And yet he hasn't. I don't know what to make of him any longer."
"He is what the wheel has sent us," Fortuona replied. "Have you considered what you will do?"
Beslan kept eyes forward. He was impetuous, often governed by his emotions, but no more so than the other Altarans. They were a passionate people, and were making a fine addition to the Empire now that they were properly tamed.
"I will do as has been suggested," Beslan said, face flushed.
"Wise," Fortuona said.
"May the throne stand forever," Beslan said, "and may your breath continue as long, Greatest One."
He bowed, withdrawing to do as he should. Fortuona could march to war, but these were Beslan's lands to govern. He so wanted to be part of the battle, but now he understood that he was needed here. Seleucia watched him go, nodding in approval.
"That one is becoming a strong asset as he learns proper restraint," she signed.
Fortuona said nothing. Seleucia's motions carried an implication, one that Fortuona would have missed, save for their long association. Beslan was learning. Other men, however... Matt started cursing up a storm nearby, gathered with the Shanshan commanders. She could not hear exactly what had set him off. What had she done in yoking herself to him?
"I have followed the omens," she thought.
She caught him glancing toward her before he returned to his raving. He would have to be taught restraint, but teaching him... it would be difficult. Far more difficult than teaching Beslan had been. At least Seleucia did not speak her condemnations out loud. The woman was now Fortuona's truth-speaker, though Fortuona could sense that Seleucia was finding the position grating. She would prefer to remain only Fortuona's voice. Perhaps the omens would show Fortuona someone else fitting as a truth-speaker.
"Are we really going to do as he says?" Seleucia signed. "The world is chaos," Fortuona signed back.
Not a straight answer. She did not want to give straight answers at the moment. Seleucia would puzzle out the meaning. The Shanshan commonly said, "May she live forever," in regard to the Empress. To some it was a platitude or a mere ritual of allegiance. Fortuona had always seen much more to it. That phrase encapsulated the strength of the Empire. An Empress had to be crafty, strong, and skilled if she was to survive. Only the fittest deserved to sit on the crystal throne. If one of her siblings or a member of the High Blood, like Galgan, managed to kill her, then her death served the Empire, for she had obviously been too weak to lead it. May she live forever. May she be strong enough to live forever. May she be strong enough to lead us to victory. She would bring order to this world. That was her goal. Matrem stalked past on the army's gathering grounds, passing 10 paces before Fortuona's throne. He wore an Imperial High General's uniform, although not well.
He kept snagging the poltron cloths on things. A high general's regalia was meant to give the bearer authority to enhance his grace as cloth rippled in response to his careful movements. On Matrim, it was like wrapping a racehorse in silk and expecting him to run. He had a kind of grace, but it was not the grace of court. Lesser commanders trailed after him. Matrim baffled the blood. That was good, as it kept them off balance. But he also represented disorder with his random ways and constant stabs at authority. Fortuona represented order, and she had married Chaos himself. What had she been thinking?
"But what of the sea folk, Highness?"
General Yulin said, stopping beside Matrim in front of Fortuona.
"Stop worrying about the bloody sea folk," Matrim snapped. "If you say the word sea folk one more time, I'll hang you by your toenails from one of those rockin' you fly about on and send you off to Shara."
Yulin seemed perplexed.
"Highness, I..."
He trailed off as Matt yelled,
"Savara, we're leading with pikes, not cavalry, you goat-loving idiot. I don't care if the cavalry thinks it can do a better job. Cavalry always thinks that. What are you, a bloody tyrant high lady? Well, I'll name you an honorary one if you keep this up."
Matrim stormed off towards Savara, who sat her horse with arms folded, displeasure on her dark face.
"I don't care if the cavalry thinks it can do a better job. Cavalry always thinks that. What are you, a bloody tyrant high lady? Well, I'll name you an honorary one if you keep this up."
Matrim stormed off towards Savara, who sat her horse with arms folded, displeasure on her dark face. Yulin, left behind, looked completely bewildered.
"How does one hang a person by their toenails?"
Yulin asked, softly enough that Fortuona barely heard.
"I do not think that is possible. The nails would break off."
He walked away, shaking his head. To the side, Seleucia signed, "Beware, Galgan approaches." Fortuona steeled herself as Captain General Galgan rode up. He wore black armor rather than a uniform like Matt's, and he wore it well. Commanding, almost towering, he was her greatest rival and her strongest resource. Any man in his position would be a rival, of course. That was the way of things. The proper way of things. Matrim would never be a rival. She still did not know how to think of that. A piece of her, small, but not without strength, thought she should have him put away for that very reason. Was not the Prince of the Ravens a check upon the Empress? To keep her strong by providing a constant threat? A woman was most resourceful with a knife at her throat. A proverb uttered by Varuota, her great-great-great-grandmother. She would hate to put Matrim away. She couldn't until she had a child by him anyway. It would be ignoring the omens to do otherwise. Such a strange man he was. Each time she thought she could anticipate him, she was proved wrong.
"Greatest one," Galgan said. "We are nearly ready."
"The Prince of the Ravens is dissatisfied with the delays," she said. "He fears we are joining the battle too late."
"If the Prince of the Ravens has any real understanding of armies and battlefields,"
Galgan said, his tone indicating that he didn't believe such a thing was possible,
"he will realize that moving a force of this size requires no small effort."
Up until Matrim's arrival, Galgan had been the highest-ranking member of the Blood in these lands other than Fortuona herself. He would dislike being superseded suddenly. As of yet, Galgan had command of their armies, and Fortuona intended to let him continue to lead. Earlier today, Galgan had asked Matt how he would gather their forces,
and Matt had taken it as a suggestion to do just that. The Prince of the Ravens strode about giving orders, but he did not command. Not fully. Galgun could stop him with a word. He did not. Obviously, he wished to see how Matt handled command. Galgun watched Matt. Eyes narrowed. He did not fully know how the Prince of Ravens fit into the command structure. Fortuona had yet to make a decision on that. Nearby, a burst of wind carried away some dust. It revealed the small skull of a rodent peeking from the earth. Another omen. Her life had been cluttered with them lately. This was an omen of danger, of course. It was as if she strolled through deep grasses, passing between stalking Lopar and among holes dug to catch the unwary. The dragon reborn had knelt before the crystal throne, and the omen of peach blossoms, the most powerful omen she knew, had accompanied him. Troops marched past, officers shouting orders in time to the steps. The Rakan calls seemed timed to the beats of the falling feet. This was what she would be leaving for an unknown war in lands she barely knew. Her lands here would be virtually undefended, a foreigner of newly minted loyalty in command. Great change. Her decisions could end her rule and indeed the Empire itself. Matrim did not understand that. "Summon my consort," Fortuona signed, tapping the armrest of her throne. Seleucia voiced the order to a messenger. After a short time, Matt rode up on his horse. He had refused the gift of a new one, with good reason. He had a better eye for horseflesh than the Imperial stable master herself. Still, Pips. What a silly name. Fortuona stood up. Immediately, those nearby bowed. Galgun dismounted and went down on his knees. Everyone else prostrated themselves to the ground. The Empress standing to proclaim meant an act of the Crystal Throne. "Blood and ashes," Matrim said. "More bowing? Have you folks nothing better to do? I could think of a few dozen things if you can't." To the side, she saw Galgun smile. He thought he knew what she was going to do. He was wrong.
"I name you Notai, for you are a bringer of destruction to the Empire's enemies. Let your new name only be spoken from now into eternity, Notai. I proclaim that Notai, Prince of the Ravens, is to be given the rank of rod-holder in our armies. Let it be published as my will." Rod-holder. It meant that should Galgun fall, Matt would have command.
Galgun was no longer smiling. He would have to keep watch over his shoulder lest Matt overcome him and take control. Fortuona sat down.
"Notai?"
Notai said. She glared at him. "Keep your tongue for once," she thought at him. "Please."
"I kind of like it," Notai said, turning his horse and trotting away.
Galgun regained his saddle.
"He will need to learn to kneel," the general muttered, then kicked his horse forward.
It was an ever so small offense, deliberate and calculating. Galgun had not addressed the words to Fortuona directly, instead acting as if they were just a comment to himself. He sidestepped, calling her greatest one. It was enough to make Seleucia growl softly and wiggle her fingers in a question.
"No," Fortuona signed. "We need him."
Once again, Notai did not seem to realize what she had done and the risk inherent in it. Galgun would have to consult with him on their battle plans. The rod-holder could not be left out of meetings, as he had to be ready to take control at any moment. Galgun would have to listen to his advice and incorporate it.
She bet upon her prince in this, hoping that he could manifest again the unexpected genius in battle that had so impressed Furik Kareed.
"This is bold," Seleucia said. "But what if he fails?"
"We will not fail," Fortuna replied, "for this is the last battle." The pattern had placed Notai before her, had shoved her into his arms. The dragon reborn had seen and spoken truth about her. For all the illusion of order, her rule was like a heavy rock, balanced on its smallest point. She was stretched thin, reigning over lands unaccustomed to discipline. She needed to take great risks to bring order to chaos. She hoped that Seleucia would see it that way and not publicly denounce her. Fortuna really would need to find a new voice, or appoint someone else as truth speaker. Having one person fill both roles was drawing criticism in court. Notai suddenly came riding back, holding to his hat. "Tuan!"
"Why is it so hard for him to understand names?" Seleucia asked with a wiggle of her fingers. Fortuna could almost read the sigh in those motions.
"Notai," Fortuna asked, "you may approach."
"Bloody good," Notai said, "since I'm already here. Tuan, we need to move now. The scouts just came back. Egwene's army is in trouble."
Yulun rode up just behind Notai, then dismounted and bowed himself full to the ground.
"Rise," Fortuna said. "Is this true?"
"The army of the Maroth Damani has suffered a grave defeat," Yulun said. "The returning fists of heaven describe it in detail. This Amarlin's armies are scattered, in turmoil, and retreating at speed."
Galgun had stopped nearby to receive a messenger, no doubt being given a similar report. The general looked at her.
"We should move in to support Egwene's retreat," Notai said. "I don't know what a rod holder is, but from how everyone's reacting, I think it means I have control of the armies."
"No," Fortuna said. "You are third, behind me, behind Galgun."
"Then you can order a move right now," Notai said. "We need to go. Egwene is getting stomped."
"How many Maroth Damani are there?" Fortuna asked.
"We have been watching this army," Yulun said. "There are hundreds. The entirety of the White Tower that remains. They are exhausted, being driven forth by a new force, one we do not recognize."
"Tuan," Matt warned.
Great change. So this was the meaning of the dragon's omen. Fortuna could swoop in, and all of those Damani would be hers. Hundreds upon hundreds. With that force she could crush the resistance to her rule back in Shanshan. It was the last battle. The world hung upon her decisions. Was it truly better to support these Maroth Damani in their desperate fight here? Or should she use the chance to retreat to Shanshan, secure her rule there, then defeat the Trollocs and the Shadow with the might of the Empire?
"You gave your word," Notai said softly. "I signed a treaty," she said. "Any treaty can be broken, particularly by the Empress."
"Some empresses might be able to do that," Notai said. "But not you, right?"
"Like, Tuan. You gave him your word."
Order in one hand. Something known, something she could measure. Chaos in the other. Chaos in the form of a one-eyed man who knew Arthur Hawkwing's face. Had she not just told Seleucia she would bet upon him?
"The Empress cannot be constrained by words on a paper," Fortuna said. "However, in this case, the reason I signed the treaty remains and is real.
We will protect this world in its darkest days, and we will destroy the shadow at its root. General Galgun, you shall move our forces to protect these Marath Damani, as we will require their aid in fighting the shadow. Notai relaxed.
Good. Yulin, Galgun, let's get planning. And send for that woman, Tylee. She seems like the only bloody general around here with her head on her shoulders. And
he went on talking, riding off, giving orders that he really should have allowed Galgun to give. Galgun studied her from horseback, his face unreadable. He'd consider this a grave mistake. But she? She had the omens on her side.
Those dreadful black clouds had been Lan's companion for far too long. He had grown weary indeed of seeing them each day, expanding toward infinity in all directions, rumbling with thunder like growls from the stomach of a hungry beast. "The clouds seem lower today," Andir said from his horse beside Mandarb. "The lightning is touching down. It doesn't do that every day." Lan nodded. Andir was right. It did look bad. That didn't change a thing. Agomar had chosen the place for their battle alongside the river roaring on their western flank, using it to protect that side. Nearby hills provided archer positions, and it was atop one of these that Lan and Andir waited. Ahead, the Trollocs gathered for an assault. They would come soon. Closer by, Agomar had placed heavy cavalry in the valleys for flanking attacks once the Trollocs charged, light cavalry behind the hills to help the heavy cavalry withdraw when the time came. Agomar kept grumbling about not having any pikes, though it was the lack of foot that had facilitated this successful retreat. "For all the good it has done," Lan thought gloomily as he studied the near-endless sea of Trollocs. His men had picked their battles carefully, killing tens of thousands while losing only thousands, leaving Shinar burned and unable to sustain the Trolloc advance. None of it seemed to have mattered. They were losing this fight. Yes, they had delayed the Trollocs, but not well enough, and not long enough. They would soon be trapped and destroyed, with no aid coming from Elaine's army, which was pressed just as badly. The sky darkened. Lan looked up sharply. Those clouds were still there, but they grew much more ominous. The land was cast into deep shadow.
"Blast it," Andir said, looking up. "Has the Dark One somehow swallowed the sun? We'll have to carry lanterns to fight, even though it's the middle of the day."
Lan placed his hand to his breastplate. Beneath the armor, Nynaeve's letter rested next to his heart.
"Light. May her fight go better than my own."
Earlier today, she and Rand had entered the Pit of Doom itself. Across the battlefield, the tired channelers, pulling their eyes from the terrifyingly dark sky, sent up lights. It wasn't much to see by, but it would have to do. But then the darkness receded, and daylight returned, clouded as had become usual.
"Gather the High Guard of Malkir," Lan said.
That was what his protectors were calling themselves. It was an old Malkieri term for the king's battlefield guard. Lan wasn't certain what to make of the fact that Prince Kaisel, who was from Kandor, considered himself one. Many of Lan's Malkieri had very little true Malkier blood. They came to him as an honor, more than anything else. The prince was another matter. Lan had asked him and his companions if they should be swearing to a foreign king, no matter how friendly. The only reply he'd received was,
"Malkier represents the borderlands in this war, Daishan."
Lightning flashed nearby. The clap of thunder beat against Lan like a physical thing. Mandar barely stirred. The animal was growing accustomed to such strikes. The High Guard gathered, and Andir took up Lan's banner, affixing it to the socket on his saddle so that he could carry it, but still swing a sword. Their orders arrived from Agomar. Lan and his men would be in the very thick of the attack. Once the Trollocs charged, the heavy cavalry would hit the flanks to break up their momentum. Lan and his men would hit the creatures face on. As Lan preferred it. Agomar knew better than to try to coddle him. Lan and his troops would hold the center ground before the hills, forcing the Trollocs to fight in such a way that the archers could lob volley after volley into their back ranks. Harrying forces would be held mostly in reserve to prevent the enemy sweeping around their right flank. The river was on their left, a natural deterrent to the Trollocs. A good plan, if any plan could be considered a good one in the face of such overwhelming odds. Still, Agomar was not making mistakes that Lan could see. He complained of troubled dreams lately, but considering the war they fought, Lan would have been more worried if the man hadn't dreamed of death and battle. The Trollocs started to move.
"Forward!"
Lan called as the trumpets sounded in the air, accompanied by thunder from above.
A short distance from the walls of Kyrian, Elaine rode Moonshadow along the front lines. The army had formed up according to Bashir's battle plans, but she was worried. They had done it. A fast march upriver along the road to arrive at Kyrian in front of the Trolloc army. Elaine had positioned their force on the far northern side of Kyrian to face the Trolloc army coming in from that direction. She had also left some of the dragons and a company of bowmen downriver to deter the Trollocs trying to cross the river there. They would withdraw quickly northward when it became impossible to prevent the enemy from crossing. Beat the army ahead, then face the one behind. It was their only chance. The kinswomen were exhausted. Elaine had required many gateways to move her men. Their fatigue meant Elaine would have no channelers in this fight. The women would be hard-pressed to make small gateways to Mayen to deliver the wounded for healing. Elaine's army was slightly larger than that of the Shadow Spawn, but her men were exhausted. Amid the anxiety of a coming battle, some slumped in their lines, pikes tipping forward. Those who stood firm had reddened eyes nonetheless. They still had Aludra's dragons. That would have to be enough. Elaine hadn't slept the night before. She'd spent the time searching for inspiring words, seeking something she could say this day that would have meaning. What did you say when all was coming to an end? She halted Moonshadow at the front of the line of Andoran soldiers. Her words would be relayed using weaves to the entire army. Elaine was surprised to see that some of the Aiel were drawing close to listen. She wouldn't have thought they'd care about the words of a Wetlander queen. She opened her mouth to speak, and the sun went out. Elaine froze, looking upward with shock. The clouds had parted above them. They often did when she was near. One way the bond with Rand manifested, and so she'd been expecting an open sky and light for this battle. The sun still shone up there, but occluded. Something solid and dark rolled in front of it. All across her army, men looked up, raising fingers as they were swallowed by darkness. Light. It was hard to keep from trembling. She heard cries through the army. Lamentations, worries, cries of despair. Elaine gathered her confidence and kicked her horse forward. "This is the place," she announced, enhancing her voice with the one power to project across the field. "Where I promise you, we will win. This is where I tell you that days will continue, that the land will recover. This is the time when I promise you that the light will return, that hope will survive, that we will continue to live." She paused. Behind the army, people lined the top of Kyrian's city walls. Children, women, and the elderly who were armed with kitchen knives and pots to throw down should the Trollocs destroy the army and come for the city. There had barely been time to contact them. A skeleton force of soldiers guarded the city. Now their distant figures huddled down as darkness ate the sky. Those walls offered a false safety. They meant little when the enemy had dreadlords. She needed to defeat the Trolloc army quickly, not hide and allow them to be reinforced by the larger force to the south. "I am supposed to reassure you," Elaine shouted to the men. But I cannot! I will not tell you that the land will survive, that the light will prevail. Doing so would remove responsibility. This is our duty, our blood that will be spilled this day. We have come here to fight. If we do not, then the land will die. The light will fall to the shadow. This is not a day for empty promises. Our blood is the fire within us. Today, our blood must drive us to defeat the shadow. She turned her horse. The men had looked away from the darkness above toward her. She wove a light, high in the sky above her, drawing their attention. Our blood is our passion, she shouted. Too much of what I hear from my armies is about resistance. We cannot merely resist. We must show them our anger, our fury at what they have done. We must not resist. Today, we must destroy. Our blood is our land. This place is ours, and we claim it. For our fathers and mothers, for our children. Our blood is our life. We have come to give it. Across the world, other armies are pushed back. We will not retreat. Our task is to spend our blood, to die advancing. We will not remain still. No! If we are to have the light again, we must make it ours. We must reclaim it and cast out the shadow. He seeks to make you despair, to win this battle before it begins. We will not give him that satisfaction. We will destroy this army before us, then destroy the one behind. And from there, we bring our blood, our life, our fire, our passion to the others who fight. From there, it spreads to victory and the light. She honestly didn't know what kind of response to expect from a battlefield speech. She'd read all of the great ones, particularly those given by queens of Andor. When younger, she'd imagined the soldiers clapping and shouting, the response given to a gleeman at a rowdy tavern. Instead, the men raised weapons to her, drawn swords, pikes lifted, then thumped back against the ground. The Aiel did give some whoops, but the Andorans looked at her with solemn eyes. She had not inspired them to excitement, but to determination. That seemed the more honest emotion. They ignored the darkness in the sky and turned eyes on the goal. Birgitta walked up beside her horse. That was quite good, Elaine. When did you change it? Elaine blushed, thinking of the carefully prepared speech she'd memorized last night while repeating it half a dozen times to Birgitta. It had been a work of beauty, with allusions to the sayings of queens through the ages. She'd forgotten every word of it once that darkness had come. This one had spurted out instead. Come on, Elaine said, looking over her shoulder. The Trolloc army was arriving opposite hers. I need to move into position. Into position? Birgitta asked. You mean that you need to go back to the command tent? I'm not going there, Elaine said, turning Moonshadow. Blood and bloody ashes, you aren't. Birgitta, Elaine snapped. I am in command, and you are my soldier. You will obey. Birgitta recoiled as if slapped. Bashir has the command tent, Elaine said. I'm one of the few channelers of any strength this army has, and I'll be drawn and quartered before I let myself sit out the fight. I'm easily worth 1,000 soldiers on this battlefield. The babes, Even if Min hadn't had that viewing, I'd still insist on fighting. You think the babes of these soldiers aren't at risk? Many of them line the walls of that city. If we fail here, they will be slaughtered. No, I will not keep myself out of danger, and no, I will not sit back and wait. If you think it's your duty as my warder to stop me, then I will bloody sever this bond right here and now and send you to someone else. I'm not going to spend the last battle lounging on a chaise and drinking goat's milk. Birgitta fell silent, and Elaine could feel her shock through the bond. Light, the woman finally said. I won't stop you, but will you at least agree to back away for the initial arrow volleys? You can do more good helping the lines where they're weakened. She allowed Birgitta and her guards to lead the way back to a hillside near Aludra's dragons. Talmanis, Aludra, and their crews waited with more anxiety and eagerness than the regular troops. They were tired, too, but they'd also seen little use during the forest battles and the retreat. Today was their chance to shine. Bashir's battle plan was as complex as any that Elaine had been a part of. The bulk of the army positioned itself almost a mile north of the city, beyond the four-gate ruins outside the city walls. The army's lines ran east from the Alguenia, across a hillside that sloped down across an approach road to the Jangai gates on the flats, all the way to the ruins of the Illuminator's chapter house. Ranks of foot soldiers, mostly Andorans and Kyrianen, but some Gildanin and White Cloaks as well, bowed out like a half-moon across the front of Elaine's forces. Six squadrons of dragons rolled up atop the hill behind the foot. The Trollocs would not reach the city without defeating this army. Estienne had the band's cavalry on one flank, while the Mayenner winged guards covered the other. The rest of the cavalry was held in reserve. Elaine waited with patience, watching the Trolloc army prepare. Her biggest worry was that they'd just sit there, waiting for their fellow Trollocs to arrive from the south and attack Elaine simultaneously. Fortunately, that didn't happen. They had apparently been commanded to take the city, and they were planning to do it. Bashir's scout reports indicated that the second army was a little over a day's march away, and could arrive late on the morrow if they marched hard. Elaine had until then to defeat this northern force. Come on, Elaine thought. Move! The Trollocs finally began to surge forward. Bashir and Elaine were counting on them to employ their usual tactic, overwhelming numbers and sheer force. Indeed, today the Trollocs crashed forward in a large mass. Their goal would be to overwhelm the defenders, shattering their lines. Her troops stood firm, knowing what was coming next. The dragons began to bellow, each like innumerable hammers falling at exactly the same moment. Elaine was now a good 100 paces from them, and still she had the urge to cover her ears. Rolling clouds of white smoke began to fill the sky above the dragons as they fired. The first few shots fell short, but Aludra and her men used the shots to adjust range. After that, the eggs fell among Trollocs, ripping through their ranks, tossing them into the air. Thousands of body parts fell to the crimson-splattered ground. For the first time, Elaine was frightened of the weapons. Light. Birgitta has been right all along, Elaine thought, imagining what it would be like to charge a fortified position equipped with dragons. Normally, in war, at least a man could depend on one thing, that his skill would be placed against that of his foe, sword against sword. Trollocs were bad enough. What would it be like for men to have to face this kind of power? We'll make sure it doesn't happen, she told herself. Rand had been right to force that peace upon them. The dragoners had trained well, and their reloading speeds were impressive. Each set off three volleys before the Trollocs hit the front lines. Elaine hadn't watched the exchange of arrows. She'd been too focused on the dragons. But she did see that some of her lines were struck with black-fletched arrows, and men were down and bleeding. The Trollocs crashed into her front ranks of crossbowmen and pikemen, who were already fading back to make way for halberdiers. Nobody used swords and maces against Trollocs, at least not while on foot, if they could help it. "Let's go," Elaine said, moving Moonshadow forward. Birgitta followed. Elaine could sense the woman's reluctant resignation. They moved down off the hill through some reserve units and entered the battle.
Rodolite Aralda had almost forgotten what it was like to have adequate resources at his command. It had been some time since he had commanded legions of men and full banners of archers. For once, his men weren't half-starved, and healers, fletchers, and good smiths stood ready to repair his troops and equipment nightly. What a wonder it was to be able to ask for something, no matter how unusual, and have it located and brought to him, often within the hour. He was still going to lose. He faced a numberless host of foes, dreadlords by the dozen, and even some of the Forsaken. He'd brought his force into this dead-end valley, seizing the jewel of the Dark One's lands, his very footstool, the Black Mountain. And now the sun itself had gone out, though the Aes Sedai said that would pass. Itarolda puffed on his pipe as he rode his horse along the ridge that edged the valley to the north. Yes, he was going to lose, but with these resources, he'd do it with style. He followed along the ridge, reaching a point above the pass into Thakandar. The valley, deep in the heart of the blasted lands, ran east to west, with Shale Ghul at the western side, and the pass on the east. One could reach this vantage only after hours of very hard climbing, or one quick step through a gateway. Handy, that. It was perfect for surveying his defenses. The pass into Shale Ghul was like a large slot canyon, the top completely inaccessible from the eastern side except by gateway. With a gateway, he could reach the top and look down into the canyon, which was perhaps wide enough to march 50 men down shoulder to shoulder. A perfect bottleneck. And he could position archers up top here to fire down on those coming through the pass. The sun finally burned out from behind the blackness above like a drop of molten steel. So the Aes Sedai had been right. Still, those swirling black thunderheads spun back, as if to consume all the sky. Since Shale Ghul lay in the blasted lands, the air was chill enough that Itarolda wore a woolen winter cloak, and his breath was white in front of him. Fog hung over the valley, thinner than it had been when the forges worked. He left the canyon mouth and moved back to a group of people that had come with him. Windfinders and other high-ranking sea folk stood in long coats that they had, hawkishly, of course, traded for before coming north. Colorful clothing peeked out beneath. It and the many ornaments on their faces seemed a strange contrast to the dull brown coats. Itarolda was Domani. He'd had more than a share of dealings with the sea folk. If they proved half as tenacious in battle as they were in negotiations, he was happy indeed to have them with him. They had insisted on coming up here to the ridge, so they could survey the valley below and pass into it. The woman at their front was the mistress of the ships herself, Zaida Din Parita Blackwing. A short woman, she had dark skin and gray strands wove through her short black hair. "The Windfinders send you word, Rodol Itarolda," she said. "The attack has begun."
"The attack?"
"The Bringer of Gales," Zaida said, looking toward the sky where the dark clouds rumbled and churned. "The Father of Storms. He would destroy you with the force of his ire."
"Your people can handle it, right?"
"The Windfinders only confront him with the power of the Bull of the Winds," Zaida said. "If it were not so, he would have destroyed us all with tempests already." She still watched the sky, as did many of her companions. There were only about 100 sea folk with him, not counting the Windfinders. Most of the rest worked with the supply teams, relaying arrows, food, and other equipment to the four battlefronts. They seemed particularly interested in the steam wagons, though Iteralda couldn't fathom why. The devices couldn't match a good team of horses. Confronting the Dark One himself, gust for gust, Zyda said. We will sing of this day. She looked back to Iteralda. You must protect the Koromor, she said sternly, as if scolding him.
I'll do my part, Iteralda said, continuing on his way. Just do yours.
This bargain was sealed long ago, Rodal Iteralda, she called after him. He nodded, continuing back along the ridge. Men stationed at watchposts saluted as he passed. Well, the ones that weren't Aiel. He had a lot of the Aiel up here, where they could use their bows. He'd put the bulk of his Tyrans down below, where those pikes and polearms would be of maximum use. They would hold the path into Shael Ghul. A distant Aiel horn blew, the signal from one of the scouts. The Trollocs had entered the pass. It was time. He galloped back along the ridge toward the valley, trailed by other commanders and King Al-Salam. When they reached the point where he had set up his primary watchpost, a vantage from which he could see miles back into the pass, Iteralda took out his looking glass. Shadows moved there. In moments he could make out the Trolloc hordes charging forward, whipped to a frenzy. For a moment he was back in Maradon, watching his men, good men, fall one by one, overrun at the hill fortifications, pulled down in the streets of the city. The explosion on the wall. Desperate act after desperate act, killing as many as he could, like a screaming man clubbing wolves as they tore him to pieces, hoping to take at least one with him into the final darkness. His hand, holding the looking glass, quivered. He forced himself back to the present and his current defenses. It felt as if he'd been fighting losing battles his entire life. That took a toll. At night he would hear Trollocs coming, snorting, sniffing the air, hooves on the cobbles, flashbacks from Maradon.
Steady, old friend,
King Al-Salam said, riding up beside him. The king had a soothing voice. He'd always been able to calm others. Iteralda was certain the merchants of Arad-Daman had chosen him for that reason. Tensions could run high when trade and war were concerned. The Damani looked at the two as much the same beast. But Al-Salam? He could calm a frantic merchant who had just lost her entire fleet at sea. Iteralda nodded. The defense of this valley. He had to keep his mind on the defense of this valley. He'd hold, not let the Trollocs boil out of the pass into Thakandar. Burnham he'd hold for months if the Dragon Reborn needed it. Every other fight, every battle man had fought and was fighting, would be meaningless if Iteralda lost here. It was time to pull out every trick he knew, every last-ditch strategy. Here, one moment of delay could earn Randall Thor the time he needed.
"Remind the men to remain steady below,"
Iteralda said, surveying through his glass.
"Prepare the logs."
Attendants relayed the orders, which went through gateway to the squads involved. That terrible force of Trollocs continued onward, clutching enormous swords, twisted pole arms or catch poles to pull down riders. They clamored through the pass, lightning streaking between clouds above.
First the logs, Iteralda thought.
As the Trollocs reached the middle of the pass, the Aiel on both sides untied piles of oiled tree trunks. There were so many dead trees and forests now that Iteralda had had no trouble fetching them through gateways, and lit them aflame. Hundreds of burning logs rolled down the sides of the pass, crashing into the Trollocs. The oiled logs set flesh afire. The beasts yelled, howled and screeched, depending on the orifice they'd been given. Iteralda raised his looking glass and watched them, feeling an intense satisfaction. That was new. In the past, he'd never been satisfied to see his foes die. Oh, he'd been pleased when a plan worked. And in truth, the point of fighting was to see the other fellow dead and your men alive. But there had been no joy in that. The longer you fought, the more you saw the enemy as being like yourself. The banners changed, but the rank and file were much the same. They wanted to win, but usually they were more interested in a good meal, a blanket to sleep on, and boots without holes in them. This was different. Itaralda wanted to see those beasts dead. He lusted after it. Without them, he'd never have been forced to suffer the nightmare at Maradon. Without them, his hand wouldn't shake when the horns of war sounded. They'd ruined him. He'd ruined them in return. The Trollocs pushed through the jumble of logs with great difficulty. Many of them had been set alight, and the Murdrow had to whip them to keep them moving. Many seemed to want to eat the flesh of the fallen. The rank scent of it made them hungry. Cooked bodies. To them, it was like the aroma of fresh bread. The Fades succeeded in driving them on, but the Trollocs soon reached the next of Itaralda's defenses. Figuring out what to do had been a trick. You couldn't plant spikes or dig ditches in that solid rock, not without running your channelers to exhaustion. He could have made piles of rock or earth, but Trollocs were big, and mounds that would slow men were less effective against them. Beyond that, moving so much earth and stone would have meant diverting workers from building real fortifications in the valley. He'd learned early that in a defensive war you wanted the fortifications to grow progressively better. You lasted longer that way, as you kept the enemy from gaining momentum. In the end, the solution had been simple. Brambles. He'd remembered huge thickets of them, dry and dead, back in Arad-Daman. Itaralda's father had been a farmer, and had always complained about the thorn thickets. Well, if there was one thing mankind was not lacking, it was dead plants. Another was manpower. Thousands had flocked to the dragon's call, and many of these dragon-sworn had little battle experience. He'd still set them fighting when that time came. For now, however, he'd sent them to cut down enormous thorn bushes. They'd place these across the pass, lashed together in masses 20 feet thick and 8 feet tall. The thorn bales had been relatively easy to place, far lighter than stones or dirt, yet amassed as they were, the Trollocs couldn't move them simply by pushing. The first ranks ran up against them and tried, but were rewarded with 5-inch thorns biting into them. The creatures in the rear pressed forward, causing the front ranks to turn in anger and rise up against those behind. This left the bulk of the Trolloc forces frozen in the pass, at his mercy. He didn't have much mercy for Shadow Spawn. Itaralda gave the signal, and the Ashaman with him, Alston, one of those who had served under him at Maradon, shot a bright burst of red light into the sky. Along the sides above the pass, more Aiel came out and began to roll boulders and more burning logs down upon the trapped Shadow Spawn. Arrows and stones followed. Anything they could shoot, throw, or drop onto those below. Most of these attacks from Itaralda's men happened farther down the pass, in the middle of the bulk of Trollocs. That caused half to pull back and shy away while the others pushed forward to get away, shoving their allies in front into the brambles. Some Trollocs carried shields and tried to protect themselves against the deadly hail. Wherever they formed together defensively and began to make a shield wall above themselves, Itaralda's channelers struck, tearing them apart. He couldn't spare many channelers for the work. Most were back in the valley, making gateways to move supplies and watching for enemy channelers. They'd already had a second run-in with dreadlords. Avienda and Cadswain Sedai had those operations in hand. Some of the Trollocs shot arrows at the defenders above, but casualties mounted as the Shadow Spawn at the front tried to hack their way through the abattis of thorns. It was slow going. Itaralda watched, cold, inside and out, as the Murdrol whipped the Trollocs into a stampede. They shoved the ones working on the thorns forward, impaling them, trampling them. Blood became a stream running back down toward the eastern end of the pass, making the Trollocs slip. They pushed the front 5 or 6 lines, breaking the thorns and the bodies of the beasts there. It still took them the better part of an hour to break through. They left thousands dead as they surged forward, then found a second abattis, thicker and higher than the first. Lyteralda had placed 7 at intervals in the pass. The second was the largest, and it had the desired effect. Seeing it made the Trollocs at the front pull up short. Then they turned and broke backward. Mass confusion resulted. Trollocs behind cried and shouted, pressing forward. Those in front snarled and howled as they tried to cut through the brambles. Some stood dazed, all the while arrows and rocks and burning logs continued to fall.
"Beautiful,"
Al-Salam whispered. Lyteralda found out that his arm was no longer quivering. He lowered his looking glass.
"Let's go."
"The battle is not through," the king protested.
"It is," Lyteralda said, turning away, "for now."
True to his word, the entire Trolloc army broke behind him. He could hear it happening, and fled eastward down the pass, away from the valley.
"One day held," Lyteralda thought.
They would be back on the morrow, and then they would be ready. More shields, better weapons at the front for cutting thorns. They'd still bleed dearly. He'd make certain of it.
Chapter 25 Quick Fragments. Suan let out a long, relieved breath as the Ammerlin, with eyes as if on fire, strode through the gateway and into their camp, with Doasine, Saarin, and several other sitters. Bryn came through the gateway after them, hurrying up to Suan. "What was decided?" she asked.
"We stand, for now," Bryn said. "Elaine's orders, and the Ammerlin agrees with them."
"We're outnumbered," Suan said.
"And so is everyone else," he said, looking westward.
The Sharans had spent the last few days gathering their forces, setting up a mile or two away from Egwene's army, which was stationed with its back to the wide river that formed the border between Kandor and Arafel. The Shadow hadn't committed to an all-out attack yet, instead sending an occasional raiding group through gateways as they waited for the slower Trolloc army to catch up. The Trollocs were here now, unfortunately. Egwene's force could have retreated again through gateways, but Suan admitted to herself that would accomplish little. They had to face this force eventually. Bryn had selected this place at the southeastern tip of Kandor because the terrain gave them an advantage, albeit a small one. The river that ran north-south on the eastern border of Kandor was deep, but a ford lay less than a quarter mile away from the hills that ran east to west along the southern border of Kandor. The Shadow's army would be making for the ford to enter Arafel. By stationing his forces at the ford and on the hills overlooking it, Bryn could engage the invading army from two directions. If pressed, he could withdraw across the ford to the Arafelin's side, the water barrier putting the Trollocs at a disadvantage against them. It was a small benefit, but in battle, sometimes the small things made all the difference. On the plains west of the river, the Shadow formed up the Sharan and Trolloc armies. Both moved across the field toward the beleaguered Aes Sedai and troops under Bryn's command. Nearby, Egwene surveyed the camp. Light. It was a relief to know that the Ammerlin had survived. Suan had predicted it, but still, light. It was good to see Egwene's face. If, indeed, it was her face. This was the first time that the Ammerlin had returned to camp following her ordeal, but she had spent several quiet meetings with the sitters in secret locations. Suan had not yet had a chance to speak with Egwene in quiet. "Egwene Alvear," Suan called after the Ammerlin. "Tell me where we first met." The others looked at Suan, frowning at her temerity. Egwene, however, seemed to understand. "Faldara," she said, "you bound me with air on our trip down the river from there, as part of a lesson in the power I have never forgotten." Suan breathed a second deeper sigh of relief. Nobody had been in that lesson on the ship but Egwene and Nynaeve. But Suan had unfortunately told Shiriam, mistress of